Today we can take up the koan case 93 in the Book of Serenity called Lutsu's Not Meeting or Lutsu's Not Understanding is the name of this ancient story. This story for contemplation. This story expounding the Zen understanding of Tathagatagarbha. Tathagatagarbha being one of the Indian names for what we sometimes call Buddha nature, our true nature. Tathagata is one of the names the Buddha called himself. Literally means the thus come one, the one coming from the thusness, the one going to thusness. I always appreciate it in old sutras when Buddha talks to people, he doesn't say, I'd like to tell you about this. He doesn't use the word I so often. He just says, the Tathagata would like to tell you about this. It'd be a reminder of those he's speaking to, of who he is, and a reminder of who they are. So Tathagata is another name for the Buddha. And Garbha in Sanskrit can mean something like womb. It is the word for womb that gives birth to new life. And it can mean like the like a storehouse. And it can mean like the heart or essence, the pith of something. And though all these meanings can apply to this Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha, it seems like people often land on this last meaning of like, the essence, the pith, the core, the essential aspect, or the heart of the Tathagata, the essence of the Buddha, the nature of the Buddha. So in some ways, Tathagatagarbha is very similar to the other Sanskrit term Buddha Dhatu. It also means like Buddha nature, awakened nature. So it's a kind of, you know, it's part of this Indian tradition of Buddha Dharma. And usually the Zen ancestors didn't get too into the details about all that because they had a new style. But this is one of those maybe few stories in the Zen tradition that specifically mentions and it's this term Tathagatagarbha and it's like the center of the story, really, the meaning of the Tathagatagarbha. So these old Zen koans, they usually start with an introduction to get in the mood for the story, like a warm-up. So here's the introduction to case 93. A precious gem hits a magpie. An old rat bites a gold piece. They don't know that they're treasures and they can't put them to use. Is there anyone who suddenly notices the jewel hidden in their own clothing. Lots of jewel imagery in this introduction and the last sentence there refers to the Lotus Sutra, where there's a story of two friends hanging out and kind of a wealthy friend and his poor friend. And the poor friend ends up drinking a little too much and kind of passes out. And while he's kind of passed out, his wealthy friend has to go to an appointment. So he thinks to himself, my poor friend, I could really help him out. I'll give him this jewel, but since he's not conscious right now, I don't want to just put it in his hand, because if somebody comes by, they might just take it. I want to have it in a secure place, so I'll sew it into his jacket. And he'll find it later, and it'll be safe in the meantime. And that's what the good friend does, and then the news, and the poor friend eventually wakes up and goes about his life, but he actually doesn't ever realize that his friend sewed this jewel into his jacket. So for years and years, he just has to beg for his food. And meanwhile, he's got this incredibly valuable, precious jewel with him all the time. But he doesn't know it's there, so he can't use it. That's the introduction to the story. And here's the story. Lu Zu asked Nan Chuan, quoting an old Zen poem here, quote, "People don't recognize the wish-fulfilling jewel. Intimately obtained from within the Tathagata Garbha, the Buddha heart." Unquote. We can get into this old poem later, but Lin Tzu asks teacher Nan Chuan, they're both Zen teachers. But Lu Zu asked Nan Chuan, "People don't recognize this wish-fulfilling jewel intimately obtained from within the Tathagata Garbha. What is this Garbha? What is this womb? What is this heart? What is this essence of the Buddha?" And Nan Chuan said, "It is me coming and going with you." And Lu Zu went on to ask, "Well, what about that which doesn't come and go?" And Nan Chuan said, "That's also the Garbha. That's also the heart of the Buddha." And Lu Zu said, "Well, what is the jewel? It's intimately obtained from within the Buddha heart." Nan Chuan called him, "Teacher Lu Zu." Lu Zu said, "Yes." And Nan Chuan said, go away. You don't meet with my words." That's the story we can explore today. First of all, in the commentary, the ancient commentary from this story. The story took place in China in the 9th century. And then a few centuries later, somebody collected these stories and wrote some verses. And then a little while after that, somebody else wrote commentaries on the stories and the verses. And that's how it goes. And then today we have another commentary on the commentary on the commentary. It's called a tradition. So just a little kind of like fact checking in the commentary, a little bit unusual. The commentator says, actually, Tian Tong, the teacher who collected the stories, actually got the names wrong in the story. I think this is pretty rare that this happens. The commentator who greatly respects Tian Tong said, let's just, for the record, let's get the names right. Tian Tong says it's Lu Tzu in this story, but it's actually really Shu Tzu. We might say, well, what's it matter to us? The commentator says, it's actually Shu Tzu ended up being Nan Chuan's successor. He was his student. Whereas Lu Tzu is actually like the elder Dharma brother of Nan Chuan. So it could go either way. But the commentator says, it's really about Shu Tzu and Nan Chuan. And Shu Tzu, right after the story happened, as you just heard, Shu Tzu was awakened. After we hear, he didn't meet, go away, you don't meet with my words. Upon hearing that, actually, he was awakened, according to the commentator. It's a success story. And we might also say, maybe it doesn't matter so much about these names, but I think it's kind of nice that it's pointing out that the names are interchangeable. We thought it was about this person, but really it was about that person. So we don't want to get too fixated on this story being about any one person, actually. It's about all of us. We could insert our own names in here. And then to make some sense of the story, and I thought that since we have a talk this morning and this afternoon, maybe this morning we could focus on the Gaura, the heart of the Buddha, and this afternoon we could focus on the jewel found intimately within the Garba, within the heart. A lot could be said about the Citta Garba. There's plenty of Indian sutras, Buddhist scriptures that expound this teaching of Buddha nature or Tathagatagarbha. But one of them that's especially wonderful is actually quoted in the commentary on the story. Zen Sori quotes some sutras, Tathagatagarbha sutras. And one that it brings up is called the Srimala Devi Simhanada Sutra. Srimala Devi is one of our women ancestors. Who taught the sutra, actually. As I recall, basically, Queen Srimala Devi basically taught this sutra. And at the end, Shakyamuni Buddha's kind of there, and he just approves everything she just said, saying, "That's right on, Srimala Devi. You said it." But she teaches the sutra. It's a Buddhist scripture taught by Queen Srimala. In the Srimala Devi Simhanada Sutra. Simhanada means lion's roar. So this is the sutra of the lion's roar of Queen Srimala Devi. And she teaches various. One of the main points of this sutra is this teaching of Tathagata Garba. So I think this is, she says, amongst other things, that this Tathagata Garba, Buddha nature, the awakened heart, or the heart of awakening, the essence of Buddha, is eternal and unchanging, she says, and the Buddha approves. It is unborn, it's undying, and it's indestructible. Of course, the Buddha taught many times that all conditioned phenomena, all experiences, are impermanent, lasting only a moment. And they're ultimately dissatisfying, partly because they only last a moment. And in this case, we're hearing about something else. This Buddha nature is eternal and unchanging. So we can therefore know that it's not one of those conditioned phenomena. It's not an experience that comes and goes. And most of the other Buddha nature sutras also make this point. Eternal, unchanging, unborn, and undying is this Buddha nature. And this next point might be unique to the Srimala Devi Sutra. She says, this Buddha nature, Tathagata Garba, is the basis, support, and foundation of all Buddha qualities. Buddha qualities are usually expressed as like unconditional love and compassion for all beings. Of course, wisdom and clarity and fearlessness and lots of other things could be added to this list of Buddha qualities. And so Tathagata Garba is the basis, support, and foundation for these Buddha qualities. I think particularly, we might be interested in the love and compassion part. The true unconditional love and unconditional compassion are natural Buddha qualities. Arisen from? It doesn't quite say that in the sutra. But we could understand that they arise from this foundation or basis. It may be better to stay with the sutra language, because we don't want to get into whether they arise or not, these qualities. But the Buddha nature is the foundation, basis, and support of these Buddha qualities. And Srimala Devi goes on to say, it's also the Tathagata Garba, the Buddha nature, is also the basis, support, and foundation of all conditioned phenomena that are other than the Buddha qualities, which I would understand to be like all the constantly changing experiences, the sights, the sounds, the sensations, the thoughts, the feelings, the emotions. These are all conditioned experiences, phenomena, and they're all impermanent, arising and ceasing. And here we could, because they are arising, we can definitely say, they arise from this basis, support, and foundation of the eternal, unchanging Buddha nature. But that teaching might be unique to this sutra, and I think it's an awesome teaching. I think this is truly the lion's roar of Queen Srimala. All the enlightened Buddha qualities depend on the basis and foundation of Buddha nature, but all the also conditioned phenomena. I think we could say, it says all conditioned phenomena, so I think that also means afflictions, kleshas, greed, hate, and delusion also arise from this basis of the eternal, unchanging Buddha nature. In other words, it's the basis of everything. It's the basis of samsara and nirvana. Everything, conditioned and unconditioned, depends on this basis, support, and foundation of Tathagatagarbha. So that's one teaching in the Srimala Devi Sutra. Another interesting teaching in the sutra is that this Tathagatagarbha, this Buddha nature, aspires to realize awakening. It aspires to nirvana in the sutra. So we don't want to personify this Buddha nature into some like kind of being that wants things. And yet it almost sounds like that. Maybe another way to put it is, if we feel some aspiration to practice and realize the Buddha way, you could say that aspiration is actually coming from our Buddha nature. That would be one way to understand this. Which sounds very similar to something Suzuki Roshi apparently said. It is wisdom which is seeking wisdom. That's kind of like the Srimala Devi Sutra. And this Srimala Devi also says in the sutra that another way of talking about this Buddha nature, it's inherently pure mind, naturally pure mind. Pure means like undefiled by greed, hate, and delusion. They emerge from it, we've heard, but they don't affect it. They don't diminish or disturb the Buddha nature. She says, this Buddha nature is naturally pure, but it's temporarily obscured by these afflictions called greed, hate, and delusion. So that's another essential teaching of this sutra. Tathagatagarbha Buddha nature is naturally pure and unstained by all our experiences, good and bad experiences. It's not changed by any of them, because we hear it's unchanging. yet it's temporarily obscured or hidden, just like a jewel sewn into the drunk person's jacket. It's temporarily hidden or obscured by greed, hate, and delusion. They obscure it, but they don't change it or affect it. Make sense? This is, I think, these are really great way of talking about Tathagata Garba. A little bit like the way that the sun is, we could say during the day, the sun is always shining, but sometimes it's obscured by the clouds. But the clouds don't change the sun at all, right? They just temporarily hide it. It's like that. The clouds are like greed, hate, and delusion. They don't sully the sun. They don't distort the sun. They don't disturb the sun. And then in the commentary of the koan here, the commentator, Wan Song, quotes this Srimala Devi Sutra a little bit more. And he says, there's two aspects of this Tathagata Garba, or Buddha nature. This is in the sutra. Two aspects of Buddha nature, or I think the sutra literally says, two kinds of wisdom in the Tathagata Garba. These are the two. There's the empty garba, empty Tathagata Garba, empty Buddha nature, free from all afflictions like greed, hate, and delusion. That's one aspect, we could say, of Buddha nature, is it's empty of greed, hate, and delusion. It's empty of these afflictions. In other words, they're not actually part of it. You could say they emerge from it, but they're not part of it, which is good news because they don't have to be there. Even while they're appearing, they're not part of the Buddha nature. They're not the Buddha nature itself. The sutra says it like this Tathagata Garba is empty of these temporary afflictions like greed, hate, and delusion. That's one aspect. The other aspect is the non-empty Tathagata Garba, which is not free from all these Buddha qualities like love and compassion. In other words, love and compassion are like natural qualities of Buddha nature. And it's almost implying they're not really removable. They're not really temporary obscurations. They are actually part of Buddha nature. But the temporary obscurations like greed, hate, and delusion are not really natural qualities of Buddha nature. They arise from it and they seem to obscure it, and yet Buddha nature is actually empty of greed, hate, and delusion. But it's not empty of Buddha qualities like love and compassion. So there's an empty Tathagata Garba and a non-empty Tathagata Garba. I think it's how the koan commentary says it. I think the sutra maybe says like two aspects or two types of wisdom regarding Tathagatagarbha. This is like we're getting a little into kind of like Indian philosophy here in a Zen koan, but that's how it is. Old Zen ancestor Wan Song didn't mind quoting the sutras. In our monthly memorial ceremonies for Zen founders, I don't know if you do this in Pali streams, Sangha, but like Tassajara in Gulch Farm, they do a monthly memorial ceremony for Suzuki Roshi. And there's these lines that open the dedication of merit, which say, "The pure Dharmakaya never appears nor disappears. But the power of Buddha's great vows reveals coming and going." It's a wonderful teaching in this memorial service. So pure Dharmakaya never appears nor disappears is kind of like Tathagatagarbha, right? It's eternal and unchanging. And there is a close relationship between in the Indian tradition between Tathagatagarbha and Dharmakaya. Dharmakaya is like the reality body of Buddha. And the relationship is that when the Tathagatagarbha is completely unobscured by these temporary afflictions of greed, hate, and delusion, it's called Dharmakaya. So really, Dharmakaya is actually the Tathagatagarbha. But we usually can say Dharmakaya is when it's completely unobscured. And Tathagatagarbha, it can still be hidden by the appearance of greed, hate, and delusion. Maybe delusion in particular here, we could say it's like dualistic thought and perception seem to hide pretty much most of the time, seem to hide this non-dual, ever-present, unchanging suchness called Buddha nature that is also aware. So going back to the, if you're getting bogged down by Indian style teaching here, let's leap over to China. There's a different style. It's a little more poetic. So Lu Tzu or Shu Tzu or you or me asked Nan Chuan, "People don't recognize the wish-fulfilling jewel intimately obtained from within Tathagatagarbha." So that's a quote from an early Zen poem in China by Yongjia, Zen ancestor Yongjia, Japanese Yoka. Japanese, the poem is called Shodoka. It's one of the classic early Chinese Zen poems, along with like the Song of the Trusting Mind. There's sometimes like a pair. Shodoka means Song of Verifying the Way by Yongjia, who is a disciple of the sixth ancestor. And this is early Chinese Chan. It's one of the first Zen poems in this world system. And Yongjia is sometimes known as the overnight guest. And that's because I think he was kind of practicing on his own, and he heard about the sixth ancestor and wanted to go meet him. And they had some great conversations. And at the end of a few hours of conversation, Yongye said, "Thank you. It's been a great meeting. I'll be going now." And it was already late, so Wenyoung said, "Well, I thought you were going to maybe like join the monastery and live here. But I'm so surprised you want to go right away. At least stay for the night." And Yongye said, "Okay, I'll stay tonight and leave tomorrow morning." And that's what he did. And so he got this nickname, the overnight guest. And I don't think that he had a lineage that continued or anything. He was a little bit of like a hermit type, as I recall. And he's most known for this poem, "Song of Verifying the Way." And it's a few pages long, this poem, so we won't read the whole thing. But this is part of it. This is the part about Tathagatagarbha. So Yongye, this is like probably 200 years before Lutsu quotes this story, this poem. The poem says, "People do not recognize the wish-fulfilling dual." Transliterates the Sanskrit, the mani dual. Chintamani jewels in India basically mean wish-fulfilling jewels. So it's the, they don't recognize this mani jewel, this wish-fulfilling jewel, intimately obtained from within Tathagatagarbha. Or obtained from within the intimate Tathagatagarbha. You could translate this in various ways. And so Thomas Cleary, in his translation of this koan, translates this as something like intimately obtained from within the mind of the realization of thusness or suchness. I think Thomas Cleary, something like that. So he very literally, the mind, like a gold mine we're talking about here. The jewel in the mind of the realization of thusness. So I think he's playing on, and maybe the original poem is playing on, there's a jewel within this mine, within this mine or storehouse. But I don't know about translating it that way. Thomas Cody likes to translate everything into English, right? Don't leave any Sanskrit words untouched. And so it's creative, but I think just reading that, you would never know that it's a translation of Tathagatagarbha, which is this important Indian teaching. So I'm trying to bring out that aspect of it today. In Sino-Japanese, it's Nyo-Rai-Zo, which is the standard translation of Tathagatagarbha. But Nyo-Rai means Tathagata, or literally means thus come. Nyo-rai is thus come, and zo means storehouse or treasury, like the Shobogen Zo is the treasury of the true Dharma eye. Jizo Bodhisattva is the earth storehouse Bodhisattva. Kshitigarbha in Sanskrit. So maybe one translation of the Chinese term zo could be mine. It's not really a standard one, but it may be that they use that to translate gold mines too. So the mine of the realization of thusness is another name for Buddha nature, literally Jatakadagarbha. People do not recognize this wish-fulfilling jewel that is intimately obtained from within Jatakadagarbha, Buddha heart. The poem goes on. It's, I think we're talking about the jewel here. Its miraculous workings are neither empty nor non-empty. Sounds to me like old Zen ancestor Yongjia is kind of riffing on the Srimala Devi Sutra. Probably not just coincidence, it could be. People don't recognize the wish-fulfilling jewel intimately obtained from within the Jatakadagarbha. Its miraculous workings are neither empty nor non-empty. One complete light, or one circle of radiance, form without form. This is the poem. I'll skip a few lines here, and then poem goes on to say, just verify, referring to the title of the poem, just verify this, just know, just verify, just know, Yongjia says. It's not difficult, he says, to see images in a mirror, but who can take hold of the moon in water? So these images in a mirror, I think, is just a great way of talking about how this Jatakadagarbha works. And since we're not looking at a mirror right now, but we are looking at a computer screen, each of us, our phone or something, same metaphor. But this is a good one. I always appreciate this age of Zoom that we're in, this Zoom pandemic. Gives us a chance to constantly explore the relationship of images and screen while actually looking at images and screen. So it makes, I think, the fact that we're doing this on Zoom is so wonderful, so much better than meeting in person, where we couldn't explore particular amazing relationship of images and screen. So we're all looking at a bunch of images and they're moving. So people are sitting very still, so they're barely moving, but we can make more movements just to make sure we know that all the images on the screen are arising and ceasing, are constantly changing, are these are impermanent phenomena. These are experiences coming and going. Visual ones, but also sounds are coming almost like out of the screen. And so everything that we're seeing on the surface of the screen is like all our experiences of seeing and hearing and sensing and thinking and feeling impermanent phenomena. And then they're all happening. All experiences we've ever had, have always been, are now, and will always be happening within this vast, empty space of awareness. Kind of like, in this metaphor, this analogy, kind of like the screen, and I think this analogy is so great because we're looking at the images right now, but we're also looking at the screen. Like, we are, right? but we never think of that when we're looking at the computer screen. I mean, usually not anyway. That we're actually looking at a flat, unchanging screen. And maybe since we're talking about it now, as we're looking at the images, see if you can let a kind of shift of perspective happen, where you actually intend to, like, I know there's all these images here, and without turning off the images, turning off the computer, can I actually see the screen at the same time? Like, look at it as a screen, and maybe you feel like your eyes actually change focus. I think that's how it is. I was noticing this in a mirror the other day. I think it's even more pronounced in a mirror because your eyes focus on the image of your own face kind of behind the mirror. So it's a little bit longer, even longer distance than a computer screen. And your eyes are focused on that image to see it clearly. But then if you try to see the mirror itself, your eyes have to shift focus and the image of your face turns blurry. You can try that out in a mirror sometime to do this shift of perspective, and you can feel the shift in that case because your eye muscles change. Now, I think it's the same now with the screen, but it's a little less pronounced. See if you can, without looking at the black edges, that makes it too easy. The zoom edges. Look right at, like, the images of moving image and see if you can see the screen right there. You are seeing the screen, right? We're all seeing the screen. But it's very strange to, it's almost like you can't quite tell how far the screen is because we're so focused on the distance of how the image appears, because images usually appear at a certain distance. But this is a great analogy for Buddha nature is like this screen. It's unchanging. We're always looking at it. It's never gone. You're never not seeing it. But we're so into images, we're so into the temporary experiences that we just don't notice this hidden jewel sewn into our clothing with us all the time. Or like the introduction says, like old rats biting on a gold piece. Like they don't know how valuable it is. The screen valuable? The screen, like the sutra says, right? The screen is like the basis, support, and foundation of all conditioned phenomena, all the images, particularly on it. These, we couldn't see each other if it weren't for the screen. And yet it's so easy to ignore the screen. And another nice thing about this analogy is that the images and the screen are like inseparable. It sounds paradoxical, but this analogy that we're actually looking at right now, the screen and the images, kind of points out how what seems like a paradox is actually, can really be the case. In other words, the paradox is like, there's this constantly changing, impermanent experiences that are inseparable from this unchanging, ever-present screen. If we say, there's all these experiences that are constantly changing in our mind, they are inseparable from completely not non-dual with the awareness of them. Might sound paradoxical, but we can see these images are inseparable from the screen, but the screen's not changing and the images are. We could say the screen's the foundation, the basis and support for the images. We can also say the screen is actually like giving rise to the images. We could say the images are like a coloring of the screen. We could say the images are a like display of the screen. And we can also say that however like messy these images are, they don't ever defile the screen. You know, like a really horrible image on the screen, but the screen is exactly the same with every experience. And it's a key aspect of Tathagatagarbha here. And it may be obvious that the liberative aspect of this kind of teaching, right? Because if we can get in touch with this ever-present awareness in which all experiences are happening, we can start to explore its qualities. And particularly in this, if we're talking about this, how the images don't dirty the screen, right? Our thoughts and emotions don't like taint our Buddha nature. And that has big implications for practice and realization. Without removing our thoughts and emotions, seeing that there is natural arising or display from and as Buddha nature, we can see that there is a reality here called the unchanging Buddha nature that is free from suffering. That's a major implication, because that's what the Buddha's main teaching, I think, was there is suffering and there is the cessation of suffering. And we all want to be happy and free from suffering. So this is one possibility of that in the Buddhist tradition. That there's a realm that's always present, a reality, we could even say. It's always present because, in fact, I think that's what we usually mean by reality is something that's always present. Reality doesn't come and go, right? So thus we can say that Buddha nature, if it's really eternal and unchanging, it is reality. And this reality does not suffer. It's intimately non-dual with suffering. Remember, suffering is these temporary afflictions and their results. It's like those might not stop right away, but we could see. Like, for example, I could have my legs could be hurting right now. So like there's some kind of pain happening, but that pain is like an image on the surface of the screen of Buddha nature. It's, and it doesn't change the Buddha nature. And we don't have to get rid of the leg pain in order to realize the reality that's eternally free from discontent and suffering. I don't know if you can follow that, but that's like a major point. That and all this is something that's not like some distant thing that we have to struggle for a long time to find. We're looking at the images and we're saying, it's going to take a long time to discover the screen here. And it maybe does seem that way because it's like, I can't see it. We are seeing it, right? But we feel we're looking for the screen usually as another experience happening on the screen. That's what makes it kind of tricky. We think Buddha nature in some subtle way or gross way. We're maybe expecting or Buddha nature will be another one of these temporary experiences happening in the space of awareness instead of the space of awareness itself, which is not an experience. So I better stop talking so that we can at least have a little time for clarification of these matters. Do you have is there anything to be clarified more here? Hopefully this should bring up like billions of detailed questions, which you're welcome to ask. I have many myself, but the main gist, okay, Jodi. By the way, you can do like Jodi did is raise hand button is probably in the participants.
Icon
at the bottom there.
It's in the reactions. But I just wanted to say thank you. The last thing you were talking about in terms of looking for the screen as another experience that happens on the screen, that was really, really lovely and really helped me a lot. Because I've been thinking not that clearly about that, but that's sort of been on my mind, like, you know, if I'm trying to move myself towards this broader, whatever the word is for it, but yet, you know, I want to have, like, I want to, my Zazen to be satisfactory in a certain way. And, you know, so that's just another experience, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
That's very, very helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Especially we can like charge it up even more if we start using words like awakening and enlightenment. Yeah. And we really like, I want that experience. So we just naturally, we use these nouns like this. We think of a noun as some kind of thing that happens rather than some kind of experience rather than experiencing itself. I would say that awareness in the way we're talking about here, awareness, experiencing, and knowing are all synonyms here. And so experiencing may be kind of helpful because it's not a noun. Awareness is a noun. So maybe being aware is maybe even more clear that it's not something that we grasp, and yet it's always present. And it takes a little exploration to really like confirm how this simple being aware, experiencing itself, never suffers. It, of course, it experiences suffering, but suffering is like the experience happening within this boundless field of experiencing, and to kind of like make it, even though they're inseparable, the experience and the experiencing are inseparable. It seems essential to clarify the difference between these two inseparable truths. We could say the ultimate truth of ultimate reality experiencing is inseparable from the conventional truth of experiences. Cody.
Right. I just wanted to say thank you as well for the teaching of the Shamala Devi Sutra and your elaboration on it. I felt like you reconciled two things for me One is, I love the teachings of Rupert Spira, and I could totally tell his some of the words and the but just reconciling his teachings and my love for Zen as well. And I was wondering how I could do those two things. And that sutra definitely.
Yes, I'm a big fan of Rupert Spira, and I don't find any contradiction between his teachings and Zen, especially if we're looking at Zen from this Tathagatagarbha perspective. I think that's where it really meets other kinds of non-dual teachings. Most easily meet. Even Prajnaparamita emptiness is a little bit where there's also the ultimate truth of emptiness, which is complete ungraspability, no thingness, kind of like that, is inseparable from the conventional truth of appearing things. So it's similar. And yet, I think the biggest difference between this Tathagatagarbha and teachings and Prajnaparamita and middle way emptiness teachings is that in this case, emptiness is aware, and awareness is empty. That's the, this is, we could also call it the third turning of the Dharma wheel. Starts bringing in this aware emptiness. And I think that the beauty of this style of teaching is it's more accessible to actual experiential verification. Because just emptiness, maybe it depends on the person, but in the Buddhist tradition, this second turning of wheel teachings, which just teach like emptiness is no thingness, usually involve a lot of kind of philosophical reasoning and to kind of deconstruct things. And there's less, hardly any emphasis maybe on awareness itself. Whereas in our experience, awareness itself is without any philosophical analysis, just experiential tasting, here it is. So, yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Jason.
Hi. Could you talk a little bit more about how Prajnaparamita fits into this?
Yeah, well, in a way, it's, I just did. So we could say that in a sense, they're not really different. We're sometimes Tathagatagarbha, it's always empty. We just heard here Srimala Deva say it's empty of all these afflictions, she said. And so that's one way of talking about emptiness. Another way to say the same thing is awareness, this very present awareness right now that we all share, is empty of anything other than itself. That's a kind of Buddha nature way of talking about emptiness. It's different. It's completely empty means, I think in all traditions, empty means is like a complete absence or lack. Shunya means empty of anything there. But in this Buddha nature teaching, sometimes it's said awareness. This is kind of a way of talking about non-duality using the word emptiness, right? Awareness is empty of anything other than itself. That's a Buddha nature way of talking about emptiness. And a Prajnaparamita way of talking about emptiness is that all phenomena all things, all experiences are empty of themselves. Sometimes it's said. You could also say empty of independent existence is another way it's said. I think it's a little more radical to say all phenomena are empty of themselves. Means that, we're looking at an image on the screen, and it's empty of existing in and of itself. Like it's like just a bunch of conditions, like our eyes and the screen and the mind. So like these conditions arising together, kind of an image or a holographic sort of image, a mirage-like image, an illusion-like image of a face. But the face is actually empty of itself. That's sometimes part of Paramita talks this way.
So could you say that Prajnaparamita is sort of like Rigpa, is the seeing of the Buddha nature?
Yeah, so Prajnaparamita sutras, like I think everyone knows the Heart Sutra, are emphasizing there are no eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body. In other words, the eyes are empty of themselves. There aren't really eyes there, but there's definitely an appearance of eyes. And but then this word Prajnaparamita, the teaching of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, is everything is empty of itself. But interestingly, they're called Perfect Wisdom Sutras. Prajnaparamita is emphasizing the knowing of emptiness. So that's a great point that we this teaching, this kind of Buddha nature teaching that's so much about awareness and knowing appears in the very title of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, even though the sutras themselves don't say that much about knowing. You could say they're talking about absence of things. But the kind of the point is the knowing of the absence of things. So yeah, in that way, it's very similar to Buddha nature.
Okay,
I think the project. Another thing is Prajnaparamita sutras. The sutras themselves would start to feel very uncomfortable talking about in this language of eternal and indestructible. Srimala Devi is quite comfortable using those words, but Manjushri teaching Prajnaparamita, I think usually feels like it's not that it's untrue, but it's like as soon as we start saying eternal and indestructible, people are gonna try to grasp something. So let's, instead of saying that, let's have our method be just negating everything. There's no eyes, there's no ears, there's no nose, there's no tongue, there's no body, and there's no mind. And then if Srimala Devi came and had a conversation with Manjushri, she'd say, I totally agree with you. And I would further add that the true nature of the eyes and ears, the true nature of the eyes and ears and nose and color and sound is indestructible and eternal. And Manjushri would take his sword out and cut off her head. Can you see how, like, just that might sound like a crazy statement, right? But just again, coming back to the analogy, the images in the screen. We're looking at all these faces on the screen, impermanent faces that are empty of themselves. The true nature of these faces is the screen, is it not? Like, these images are actually like, what are they really made of? They're made of the screen, kind of like displaying itself as certain colors. So maybe not such a big stretch to say the true nature of all these faces on the screen is the screen. And the screen, at least in this kind of analogy, we're talking about the kind of screen that's eternal and indestructible. Of course, this computer screen is not going to last that long, but this is kind of a big proposition that this Buddha nature screen is eternal and indestructible. But the reason that Manjushri might like to cut off Srimala Devi's head when she says that is that when we hear those words, we think of some sort of like entity, some sort of thing that is indestructible. Actually, the words eternal and indestructible, I'm not sure about if E is a negation prefix in its root. I'm not sure, but in is definitely a negation prefix for destructible, right? So that's why the sutra also says unchanging. Maybe it's safer to say unchanging and indestructible, because we're just not saying that it's something that can be destroyed, or saying that it's something that changes, without positing like eternal existence. It's not like that, right? Well, maybe that's...
Dora Lee has a question.
Oh, what?
Dora Lee has a question.
Oh, Dora Lee. On the other screen here for me.
My hand's in the corner up there.
Okay. Hi.
And thank you so much for this teaching. And my question is that especially lately I've been sort of intentionally, if I'm in an interaction with somebody, intentionally, you know, sort of returning inside to a kind of breath, a kind of openness. And then it seems like something happens, like I'll say something that I hadn't been thinking of saying, or all of a sudden I'll act differently than I've acted before. And it's kind of an amazing, surprising experience, but I can't say I'm not aware of all of what that is.
Well, that is a great segue into this afternoon's conversation, where we can talk about the jewel that's hidden in the space of Buddha nature. And so it's something about spontaneous expression. And this is maybe, it's a little more into the Zen side of things. What is this jewel hidden in the mind of the realization of thusness, which seems to function almost spontaneously? And freely. So that sounds like kind of like what you're talking about, when in this place of stillness, sometimes a surprising response like emerges unexpectedly. Without you.
Not in a way. That's the sort of paradox of it all, I guess.
Yeah, well, let's explore this more this afternoon.
Okay, well, great. Thank you.
Spontaneous expression within the empty space. Oh, Will, you have it.
Thank you.
Thank you for your insightful talk this morning. And I had a dream just a week or so ago, and it kind of tied into what you were talking about. It was a large field, green grass, and people around. And as the sun was setting, I was looking down at the ground, and there was gold. And every step I would take, there'd be more gold, more. And I was amassing all this gold. And as I was holding it in my hand, I wasn't thinking, wow, I'm wealthy and rich now. I had this feeling like responsibility. So I was wondering how do you integrate freedom and responsibility? And could that be why people don't really look for that sewn in gem because of responsibility that entails, that ensues?
I mean, I guess you could say responsibility. Maybe this poor person who didn't look for the gem was so busy in his other responsibilities of begging for food, for example. I got to go beg for some food now, that he didn't kind of stop to wonder why his jacket feels heavy. Maybe like that. That would be one way of talking about the responsibility that keeps us from recognizing the treasure. And then on the other hand, you could say, as practitioners, you could say the Bodhisattva vow is the responsibility to recognize the treasure and share it with everyone. So that's the Bodhisattva responsibility. Sometimes there's this phrase like, I think this phrase may be used for either like studying a lot of teachings and understanding them, but not putting them into practice. Or another way to say it would be maybe like having a glimpse of truth, but then not following through with devoted practice. And the image is, it's like returning from an island of jewels empty-handed. And which is such a sad image, is it not? Like we visit this island of jewels, and like your dream, the ground is covered with gold, but we don't take any of it with us. That would be so sad. So I think the Bodhisattva's responsibility is to I don't know how we should say it, like fill your pockets or something with the gold in your dream. And then when you wake up, then you can like share it with everyone. Not sure if that quite works, but then maybe there's this other, maybe you're hinting at this other aspect of responsibility we might feel like, and maybe this we can get into this afternoon if we're talking about spontaneous activity in dual mind. Is what about like ethical conduct, like that kind of responsibility? And you might feel like, well, if the screen can't suffer, it's eternally at peace and content. It can't be harmed. Everyone we see is just actually the display of this one, ungraspable screen. Then we might start feeling, we might worry that we would become irresponsible in taking care of these images, because they're just images, right? Let's look at that this afternoon. We might worry, any kind of ultimate teachings, there's that kind of danger of misunderstanding them in a way that like appearances don't matter anymore. So we need responsibility to, maybe the shorthand version is, we have the responsibility to take care of appearances while knowing that their true nature is the screen of Tathagata Garbha. That fulfills two Bodhisattva vows. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them all from suffering. And Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be it. I don't think we can, these four Bodhisattva vows, we can't really pull them apart. They all come together.
Thank you.
Let's return to the island of jewels for a little while before lunch.